Welcome to Walk About the Galaxy, the astronomy podcast that asks the question, what were we talking about?
Often.
Where the science is universal, the opinions are personal, and the hosts don't put on any airs. We are Strange Charm atop the Astroquarks, also known as Josh Caldwell,
Addie Dove,
and Jim Cooney,
coming to you from the Walkabout Studio at the University of Central Florida. Remember to subscribe to us on all platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also at walkaboutthegalaxy.com, where you can see how to order a Walkabout shirt and support STEM education at the same time, or just send us a message at wtg@ucf.edu. Remember that it's just one step beyond WTF. Our stumpers today are habitatal.
I've decided, by the way, we're going to be on TikTok soon doing interpretive dances for each of the planets.
So I'm sorry.
Get ready for that.
I have so many questions right now, but I'll just say, what?
Get ready. That's
Jim's,
all I'll say.
What, Jim's been prepping
audience?
Himself for his TikTok stardom.
You've discovered TikTok?
I've discovered that it's a thing. I haven't been on it yet. I don't really know what it is. I don't really understand it.
I heard that.
But I've heard of it. I've heard of it now. And it's like really popular.
Your relationship to TikTok is sort of like William Shatner's relationship to space, I guess.
That's correct.
I've heard of the thing.
I've heard it's a thing.
I've heard something about this space thing. You've heard something about this TikTok thing?
TikTok thing. It has like a billion users now.
It does.
And we can do interpretive dancing.
Why interpretive dancing, though?
Why not?
Why not? Because you got to.
Because it's horrible.
You have to have dancing in TikToks.
Yeah, you got
to. Interpretive dancing?
Sure. Because we're going to interpret with the planets.
You're going to want to do an interpretive dance of Jupiter?
Yeah, you're damn right I am.
Is it going to be set to Holst's The Planets or like some other music?
We'll see.
Okay. I thought the TikTok things, they have these kind of like earworm things. Like, I've seen some of these videos and there's like only 5 different music clips on all of TikTok as far as I can tell. And they're all used for the same, you know. They play over and over again.
That's not true.
For different things. There's 6.
I didn't know. Maybe.
There's in fact like new music that's being discovered on TikTok.
Really?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. So we need to compose our own music.
All I'm saying is.
All right. So we have to create a Walkabout account for TikTok.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What were we talking about?
Oh, yeah. Stumpers.
Flashback. See? Meta.
Yeah.
The stumpers are habitatal.
Okay.
We have a sort of a small body theme in today's episode, and the stumper begins with that small body theme. Do you guys know who Seth Shostak is, besides a person with a sort of tongue twister name?
I know, like, generally of him.
So he's at the SETI Institute.
Yes.
He did Star Trek consulting way back a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of studies search for extraterrestrial life. And I was at some conference once where he was speaking, and there was a question about the carrying capacity of the Earth. Familiar with this concept? It's like how many people can we have, and everybody's healthy and fed? Basically.
Currently, very familiar with the carrying capacity concept.
Very familiar with your personal carrying capacity.
Personal carrying capacity. The Earth's is much larger.
Yeah.
One.
So he was very glib, I would say, about the carrying capacity by saying, it just invoked technology to solve all the carrying capacity problems and extended it even out into the asteroid belt.
Hmm.
And there's not a lot of mass in the asteroid belt, but there's a lot of surface area.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like, everybody gets a quarter of an acre or whatever, and you take the asteroids and use those and you put barges on the oceans or whatever, you can get a lot of people.
Yeah.
So suppose that you have to, in some future time, you're in the great diaspora and must live out on one of these small bodies, not on the home world. And you have the following choices. A small main belt asteroid, say something like, 29605 Joshua Caldwell. A still smallish but larger Trojan, say 100 kilometer size Trojan asteroid sharing the orbit with Jupiter, so a little bit further out in the galaxy, or a dwarf planet size 1,000 kilometer scale, Pluto scale object in the Kuiper Belt.
Question. Have we developed ways to appropriately inhabit these planetary bodies?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I've decided to let you decide what the overall parameters are.
Okay.
So you can choose, based on some sort of expanse-like future.
Sure.
Expanse being the shows and books.
Yes. I think I would choose So it's tricky.
Yeah. What are your trade-offs? What are the what's making it tricky for you?
So it's tempting to say a main belt because it's closer in.
Closer to,
you got a lot of sunshine still. Decent right. amount of sunshine still.
Right.
There's probably going to have lots of like neighbors. They're not actually close, but like you could take you your little scouting.
Could go from 2-9-6-0-5 Joshua Caldwell over to 2.
Whatever number Addie Dove.
Something Addie Dove. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you can take your little scooter, your space,
right,
scooter,
space scooter
from one
over.
Place to the other.
Yeah.
The Trojans, I don't think that would be the answer. The dwarf planets would be nice because you'd have plenty of resources probably.
Right.
And
you could go for a walk.
Gravity, that's the thing I was thinking.
Well, so that's
of.
What I'm asking because like I assume we've come up with some way to like be on these tiny moons if we're living on them. So
you can be on them, but
you can't you really can't be on them.
You just build a nice big house. It's basically like you're in a bounce house all the time. So that sounds amazing.
House. That's right. You would be basically near it.
Yeah.
Anchored to it or something, but you wouldn't be
that
able to go for a walk.
Amazing.
I mean, I don't know.
You could scoot.
If you want, you can say, okay, you're going to build a thing. You're going to get two of these asteroids and you're going to tether them together with some futuristic microfiber and have some sort of dumbbell thing going.
Sure. Then you have some gravity.
Yeah.
That sounds fun. I'm going to go main belt.
Main belt.
Yeah.
Jim.
Oh, I'm going out there.
You're going out. You want to walk around.
The problem is it's dark out there.
It is dark. I'm going to be bummed by that.
That will be hard. You can get these lights, though. They use them in Sweden, so same deal.
Yeah, like all my friends that used to live in Alaska, they just hang out at Walmart all winter.
Because of bright lights.
Because of bright lights.
Yeah. That sounds awful.
Yeah, it does sound awful.
Because like fluorescent lights are way different than like good lights.
Yes, obviously. Yeah. I'm going to bring some good lights with me that are
They sell special lighting panels for seasonal affective disorder for places where the winter nights are quite long.
Yeah. But I'm just going to have a plug. I'm going to be flying all around that asteroid and the asteroid belt. So
yeah.
That's awesome.
I want to be locked down to the surface a little bit. I mean, you're still going to be really light.
You could still like make a sort of Leonardo da Vinci helicopter probably.
And you could go ice fishing.
No, but I could finally dunk. My whole life.
Oh, right.
I've been wanting to dunk a basketball.
That's been your missing ambition in your life?
Jim, I'm going
to
get you.
I started training for that earlier. I thought it'd be really, because I'm only 5'6", so I thought it'd be awesome to be able to dunk at that height.
Sure.
It would be.
Have you ever just like lowered the rim?
You could do that. That's one way to do it.
Yes.
The other way is have minimal gravity.
Yeah. You could probably do some technology with your shoes too, I bet.
Probably. Mm.
Well, today we'll talk about asteroids, comets, binary asteroids, binary comets, impacting asteroids. There's a theme. But first, this episode of Walk About the Galaxy is brought to you by attoseconds.
Mm.
When you're measuring the time it takes for light to travel across an atom, put your stopwatch away and get your supply of attoseconds ready at 1/1,000,000,000th or 1,000,000,000,000,000th of a second.
Whoa.
The attosecond is to that everyday tick of a clock what a half second is to the age of the universe.
Ooh.
And then some. Impress your friends by telling them how long you worked out in attoseconds. Attoseconds are available now for the low, low price of 300 million billion for the blink of an eye. If you want to tap your feet to the beat of a different and extremely active drummer, get attoseconds. Attoseconds. Bet you can't eat just one.
Do we have that one recently?
I checked, but no. We had something similar.
We had Pringles.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well,
which was
so
once you pop.
You can't stop.
You just can't stop or something like that. This is not that.
It's a different potato chip.
It's a different potato chip. I think it's Lay's.
It is a different potato chip. And it is Lay's, in fact. Yeah.
Bet you can't eat
just. Attoseconds really short.
It is very short. It's about the time for a photon to go across an atom.
It's a long
That's
time.
That's insane.
It's a long time on a Planck
right,
scale.
Right, because light is super fast and atom is super small.
That's unbelievable. And yet, they're doing things here in this building.
Downstairs.
On the scale of
attoseconds.
They're
yep.
on the
making
floor,
laser
even.
Pulses that are that short.
Mike Genie does some stuff.
Well, he does definitely do some stuff, yes. But we have a very active and...
It's true. It's like the whole first floor.
And one of the leading centers for attosecond research here at UCF. Space news.
Space news.
William Shatner is going up on the next flight of New Origin.
Is he going to survive that?
New Origin.
I don't know.
He is.
You think so?
I'm sure he is. Yeah.
He's pretty old.
That's.
It's not a super. It's not as super harsh. So.
It's 3.5 G's max, and it's into the chest. It's not down the head. I'm sure he'll do fine.
He'll be fine.
I'm not worried about him. I saw him. I saw him recently.
I mean,
at
he
a convention.
Does look. He looks amazing. For a 90-year-old. He looks
90.
Like he's in his 70s.
Yeah, that's right. He looks like not bad for somebody in their 70s
right,
even.
Right.
So,
yeah.
He looked, I've seen him walking around and looks very physically fit. So I'm sure he'll do fine.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Which one of these things is he going
New
up
Shepherd,
on?
Blue Origin.
New Shepherd, Blue Origin. Okay.
Blue Origin.
And this is suborbital thing where you're
suborbital
going up.
Thing.
His whole mission is less than 11
there
minutes
was just,
long.
Okay. There was just an orbital delivery from a Soyuz capsule of an actress, a director, and a commander,
right.
A capsule commander,
right.
Up to ISS.
Right, they're beating Tom Cruise to the punch.
Yeah,
filming a video
on the International Space Station.
Well, they're filming scenes for a feature film.
For a movie, sorry.
I think videos have been filmed up there before. But
it's true.
In principle, this is scenes from some feature film where the scenes that are up there are a doctor who has to go up to a space station to...
Oh, it's a Doctor Who film?
That was good.
Thanks.
Who has to go up to the space station to deal with a medical emergency or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know the whole plot.
Sure.
And I don't know how much it'll be filmed up there, but I'm kind of hoping it's not a huge amount because it's probably going to suck, frankly.
It's also probably pretty disruptive.
Cinematically,
you know. Yeah, it seems like it'd be...
It's just not...
If there's one person with a camera, like the production quality is going to be challenging.
Right. And... So she's playing the doctor, who's playing the patient? So they're going to be pulling in one of their professional astronauts as an actor or something like that.
Maybe.
So I'm...
I also found it suspicious. So they went up and the Soyuz goes up super fast now. It only takes like... They have a direct ascent. It takes like 4 hours or something like that.
From launch to docking.
Yeah. So they went up and then conveniently the manual docking or the automatic docking failed. So, like, Soyuz was approaching station, and then they had to stop and back away because the automatic docking system failed. So, the commander, the Soyuz commander, had to take over and do a manual docking.
Oh.
And I found that very suspicious when you had a film crew on board.
Yeah.
It'll
be very interesting to see the movie come out and see if that was filmed.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That was sort of manufactured emergency. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So when they send Tom Cruise up.
Yes.
Where is he going? Is he going to the space station also? International Space Station also?
There's kind of nowhere else to go.
There's only that place. That's the only place to go
right
now.
Well, I don't know. He might go up on one of these things like those.
He's going to go up on a SpaceX.
He's going to go up on a rocket, but he's going to the International Space Station.
Right. But you could just orbit a few times and come back down.
Sure.
You could.
So I didn't know what he was supposed to do.
No, he's going to go ISS. We don't either.
He's going to ISS.
He's going to ISS.
With more people than just one camera person?
We don't
know.
I don't know the details.
I don't know.
But... My prediction is a SpaceX launch with him and one other person.
Yeah. There's another Virgin launch coming up at some point.
Right, with the Italian.
Then
we're still waiting, as we mentioned last time, for a launch date to be announced for that, but potentially this month.
Yeah. And they just re-switched around some crew, NASA astronaut crew. So the crew that was supposed to be a couple of people who were supposed to be on the Starliner test have been reassigned to different SpaceX flights that they can actually fly.
It's kind of amazing because Starliner was only hours away from its second test flight a couple months ago. And now it's still months away from that. So it seemed like one of these sort of no big deal kinds of delays.
Weird valve reading or something. Yeah.
But that was months ago. We're still waiting to find out. We do have a week from tomorrow, the launch of the Lucy mission, which we'll talk about Lucy a little bit next. But
that's International Observe the Moon Night is that day also.
Oh, okay. And Lucy is not an acronym, happily.
No.
And it's going to... several Trojan asteroids, mm-hmm. which are asteroids that share the orbit of Jupiter.
It has my favorite orbital diagram ever.
Its mission path, you mean? Yeah. Its trajectory that it's following? Yeah. Why is that?
Because it's like got the big, it has to go on a big orbit to sort of get to the different Trojans. And then it's got the two, like, Trojans are in orbit at, like, in an orbital. Where they are in Jupiter's orbit makes it so that the diagram looks like Princess Leia buns.
Oh, okay. I knew there was a punchline coming.
I was trying to visually describe it, and we'll just put a picture.
So that, yeah, there's two groups of Trojans, each one in the orbit of Jupiter, but one group 60 degrees ahead and one group 60 degrees behind.
Yeah.
And it's doing some sort of curlicues to jump from one group to the other.
So it looks kind of like Princess Leia.
Which is funny. It's named Lucy, by the way, as we mentioned years ago.
Yeah.
Dozens or hundreds of episodes ago after...
After the original skeleton, human skeleton.
Right.
Because it's supposed to be looking at ancient history of the solar system and original formation stuff.
Right. And then that's scheduled for October 16th. And then there's another planetary small body asteroid launch scheduled now. They just announced for November 23rd, which is DART.
DART.
Which is unhappily an acronym.
It's a fine acronym.
It is okay. It's a good acronym. It's acronym.
Double asteroid redirect test.
Double asteroid redirect
test? See what it used to be. I think they had to change the D.
It used to be direct, and now it's double or something. I don't know. In any event, they're going to go to an asteroid that has a little tiny moon. The asteroid they're going to is Didymos.
Double asteroid redirect test. It's because it's a double asteroid.
Right.
The moon of Didymos is...
Tiny. And they're going to smack it with something and measure how its orbit changes. And it's an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
It's the kind of experiment that I can understand.
Yay.
Unlike some of the stuff that we talk about sometimes where photons are used to like hold things and then they probe things and then there's some entanglement going on and there's some weird.
This one is you hit something with something and then you watch how
what
it happened. Changes.
Right. It's kind of like if I
That's
slap
what you
gym.
Do all the time.
Slap gym, see what happens. No. It's the same kind of thing.
You don't want to know what's going to happen then.
Yeah, but it would be a cool experiment.
Yeah.
So they're going to smack this asteroid and see what happens. But it is super tiny. I think the main sort of impetus for it is if we hit an asteroid. Well, how do we need to hit an asteroid in order to keep it from hitting the Earth?
Yeah.
And,
which we'll talk a little bit more about.
You need to hit it a lot harder than we're going to be hitting this thing.
Yes.
Let's touch on a couple of those topics. We have several small body object topics.
We'll do small descriptions because they're small bodies.
Right. Okay.
I don't know.
Do you want to do the deflect thing since
we might as well talking about DART? Yeah. We talked a few episodes ago, I think, about a study that had been doing some gas gun tests to break bits of asteroids apart, and they found that you have to hit it
not too hard, right?
And things will break apart. So it's like you're actually going to fragment stuff pretty easily,
right?
And the big question when we're doing these types of disruptions, and so with this one, DART is going to hit it, but it's not going to like disrupt the asteroid. It's going to hit it enough that it like changes its orbit, or the asteroid's moon in this case,
right? It'll make a little crater.
That impact should be enough that it like will slightly change its orbital trajectory.
Right.
So you're like poking it a little bit so that it doesn't stay on quite the same path. And generally, that's what we want to do for asteroids is sort of poke them so that they slightly change their path. But for that, you have to know 6 months, many years, decades out kind of thing so that you can do that and it'll successfully.
The further out you do that, a little change along time in advance causes
a big difference. Yeah.
Right.
When it gets to Earth.
But the closer it gets, the more you're going to have to deflect it or you're going to have to go explode it.
Explode it.
Yeah.
So the thing we were talking about earlier, the study with the Ames gas gun, they were like, you want to be careful if it's way out there and you explode it. Some of the stuff is still maybe going to still be going in the same direction and hit you. So they're like, how gently do we have to hit it to not break it up so that we truly just steer it differently?
Right. Yeah.
But then you get closer, it's probably you can't bend its path far enough.
Yeah. And so then the question is, okay, you break it up, but like how many of those pieces still hit the earth? Like how much do you disrupt? And one of the big challenges for that is like really understand, is like doing these models and really understanding where all the bits go.
Right.
Because it takes pretty intense computing to be able to do that. Fortunately, folks at Los Alamos National Labs have fancy computers.
They do.
And they are able, they've been working on some of these models for a while now. And so they just recently published a paper looking at sort of how much you would have to, or if you hit an object with like sort of a 1 megaton blast.
That's a big blast.
It's pretty big. They're all about nuclear blasts. So it says if you did in initial conditions, if you had a 1 megaton yield device deployed a few meters off the surface of a Bennu-shaped 100-meter diameter asteroid, what would happen?
Okay.
And their results are actually promising because they said they did it for 5 different types of orbits and they did the disruptions just 2 months before the impact date.
Okay.
They were able to reduce the fraction of the impacting mass by a factor of 1,000. So 99.9% of the mass misses the Earth.
Wow.
That is really good.
Yeah.
That is good.
So it's like basically you get a dispersal that is enough that it will make most of the mass miss the Earth even at just a few months out.
So that was 2 months prior to impact. So I don't know if I mentioned this, but I was actually a science advisor on the movie Deep Impact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
I had played a...
I don't think you've mentioned it this episode.
I haven't mentioned it this episode yet. I actually just got a residual check this week
for it. Was it for 15 cents?
It was for far more than that.
$15?
Even more than
that. Wow, that's a big one this time.
I know. 20-some years plus coming, as long as it's fast food. In that movie, they break up, they explode, they explode
spoiler
with a
alerts.
Nuke, a comet shortly before it hits. And, you know, when they were talking about this in the pre-production consulting meetings, we pointed out, well, blow it up, it's still going to hit. And they were like, okay, how much before impact do we have to blow it up for it to be safe? So I did a far simpler calculation.
You didn't run some
right
hydrogen
there.
Models?
I did not do what the Los Alamos folks did here in this paper, where I just said, okay, if you blow it up, typical ejecta speed is something. And if you send all of it in the optimal direction, how long does it take for it to go 1 Earth radius?
Right.
And that answer is not a big number, is on the hours scale or something like that. Of course, in the movie, it appears to happen in the blink of an eye.
Sure.
Although, you know, lots of times things appear to happen in the blink of an eye and they don't. Like people get in a car in a movie and then the next scene they're getting out of the car someplace else.
Yeah.
So.
Or you're on one side of the galaxy, then you're on the other side of the galaxy.
That's right. If it's a J.J. Abrams movie.
Exactly.
Right.
It's going to be really ironic in a cool way if.
Don't you think?
The folks at Los Alamos end up saving the world when the Los Alamos lab was formed, of course,
to blow up
build
the world.
To build the atomic bomb.
Right.
Yeah, there's a cool group of people that are basically planetary scientists there.
I mean, it's a very different place, right? It was this top secret place where they were designing
and some
the
of
atom
it is
bomb.
Still,
and now it's a...
They do a lot of top secret
stuff. Yes, I'm sure they do some stuff, but they also have clandestine...
Yeah,
science.
There's a fun little video of the splody.
Okay, so 2 months, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of thing you can do.
If it's a bigger asteroid and you hit it like 6 months out, you're still pretty safe.
Okay. All right. That's good. For big asteroids, we would know well in advance,
right?
Because we would see them. But for comets, we might not.
They're the troublesome ones.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so having the ability to explode things only months in advance may save us all. There was some tardigrade news.
How did we not lead with this?
Huh?
Yeah. How did we not lead with this? Don't tell John Hammond. Don't tell John Hammond.
What? John Hammond?
Oh, that's the guy from Jurassic Park.
Good job. Good job.
Oh.
Yeah. So there was a tardigrade fossil found in a piece of amber.
Right.
Oh, that wasn't even
Jurassic Park.
I'm looking at like three
walking thing.
I'm looking at firing tardigrades as bullets. We should talk about all these things.
What?
First, tell us about the tardigrade and the amber.
The first one, so they found a 16 million year old amber. They found a tardigrade fossil in this. And it's like a fairly well preserved fossil in that they were able to like actually look at
it.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Break that thing up and bring it back to life.
They
right.
Tardigrades survive everything.
So they, were able to measure stuff, and they actually found that it was a slightly different than modern tardigrades.
Right.
So it actually gets its own name.
Different species of tardigrade.
Different species, yeah. And they were able to like actually examine its innards. And
oh, really?
So measure.
That's amazing.
Some, yeah.
That's amazing. Looking at our current species of tardigrade, there was a study, coincidentally, I guess, that just came out recently also about how they move around.
Yeah, they like walk.
Yeah.
They have eight legs. These are these tiny little creatures that are about a half a millimeter long or something like that. So they're almost so small that you kind of like don't notice they're so small that it's like bacteria doesn't gross us out because we can't see it. They're not quite that small.
Yeah.
They're just barely big enough to maybe scare me.
They have their little tiny claws.
They have, especially since we've seen them with these, you know, microscopic images, they're kind of terrifying.
Oh, yeah, they're horrifying when you blow them up to life size. But
so they have eight legs, four on each side.
Right, but they're not spiders. And so they're not insects or spiders or anything like that. They're much smaller than.
Nor are they mammals.
Right. They're not bears. I don't even really know.
They're not pigs or bears.
They're moss pigs. Moss pigs for the win. But they do. They walk in a funny way. They walk a lot like insects do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This was weird. I was surprised that they were doing these kind of tests. They were like putting tardigrades on a whole bunch of different surfaces of different consistencies.
Seeing how they walk. Stride. Sometimes it's sort of like a hopping kind of thing. And sometimes it's just sort of like a dumpy kind of, I'm a water bear strolling across the laboratory slide kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then we have talked about tardigrades being exposed to extreme environments, including space, which will inspire our trivia. But you were excited, Jim, about another experiment.
Yeah. Well, when looking at that tardigrade walking thing, I noticed that in July 21, they had done a test firing tardigrades. Because this is something that's important. We've talked about tardigrades as... Because they can survive, like, the radiation and the vacuum of space, they might be important for, like, that panspermia thing where they might survive. But, of course, if you're gonna do that, you have to also survive the impact with the planet that you end up on. And those impacts can be very highly energetic. You're impacting at a very high speed. So they wanted to find out, can they survive that kind of thing? So they, like, basically made tardigrade bullets and fired them at piles of sand at very high velocities. It's awesome, but also
people are strange.
Yeah, I feel bad. Tardigrades were harmed in this commercial.
Yeah,
or this thing that they were.
This research.
But what they found is they can survive impacts of up to something like 0.9 kilometers per second.
Okay,
which is a pretty good pace.
Pretty fast.
That's like 2,000 miles an hour.
Oh,
wow.
Any faster though? And
when it gets faster than that.
And they just mush.
They just mush.
Tardigrades.
That's about the limit.
Where was that study published, Jim?
That one
was in astrobiology.
That one was in astrobiology.
The gun study was in astrobiology.
The previous one was in penis.
About them walking.
The walking was in penis.
But I just thought those were... Unfortunately, it sounds like their results... Because it's not just about how fast. It's about like... The
impact pressure
that they're under during the impact. And it turns out that the pressures under which they die are less than what would probably be the case if for typical impactors onto like Earth or something like that. They would almost certainly all die in that kind of thing.
Well, this is also relevant because the Bereshit, the Israeli lunar lander, had some dehydrated tardigrades on board.
Right. But that impact pressure is also greater.
It's probably higher.
Was it?
Okay. And so, unfortunately.
Although it wasn't supposed to be. It turned out to be. Well, so tardigrades probably didn't come here from space, but.
They might have.
Other animals have been to space, and
yes,
that is the
true.
Topic of our trivia.
Okay. I like this.
It's three different questions.
Okay.
The first question is, what was the first animal to be sent into space?
Okay.
Multiple choice.
Okay.
Fruit fly.
Okay.
Rhesus monkey.
Okay.
Mouse.
Okay.
Rat.
Okay.
Bullfrog. I'll tell you that it was a suborbital flight, and the animal survived.
Yeah.
As a clue. Or I don't know if that's really a clue, but it's a piece of information.
I sent monkeys up super early.
What was the first animal to orbit the moon? Also multiple choice. Your choices are tortoise,
human,
rhesus monkey, dog, or snail. And the final one is, what was the first species to produce young that were conceived in space?
SpaceX!
So not delivered in space, sure, but that were conceived in space. Also multiple choice.
Somebody thought of them in space.
And your your choices are fruit fly, human, mouse, seahorse, or cockroach. Anyway, we'll come back to that in a second after we talk about some of the other small body updates.
You lost me at cockroach.
Well, that was the last one, so you were with me till the end. Yeah. Not your favorite. You probably shouldn't live in Florida.
I know. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So this week is the week of the American Astronomical Society's big planetary science conference called the DPS.
Division of Planetary Sciences.
I never remember if it's of or for.
I think it's of.
But in any event, yeah, we call it the DPS, and it's the big planetary science meeting in the U.S.
It's one of them.
Yes, that's true. I guess the lunar LPSC might even be bigger in terms of number of attendees.
Yeah.
But in any event, that was this week.
Division 4 planetary.
It is 4, right? See, it's the tricky. They're tricky. But the DPS meeting was virtual this year.
Yep.
I had a presentation. Several of my students had a presentation. Our presentations were yesterday.
Ooh.
Our session was yesterday, coincidentally chaired by one of my former students.
Which one?
Stephanie Jarmack.
Oh, Stephanie.
Nice. I know her.
Who was chairing a ring session.
She's been on the pod.
Even though the research she did with me didn't have anything to do with rings.
Yeah.
But the virtual meeting, I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the same benefits that bumping into people and being able to have good in-depth conversations. But in any event, they had press conferences each day. And one of the discoveries announced in the press conference was from our intrepid outer solar system explorer, New Horizons, which, as we remember, flew by Pluto. Then it flew by this Kuiper Belt object called Arrokoth, which looks like this snowman or gingerbread cookie or something, a contact binary, they call it. So as it's cruising along out there, it hasn't had a close encounter with anything else yet, but it is close enough to enough objects that it's able to get higher resolution images of other Kuiper Belt objects, a couple dozen or something like that, that are sort of within its general vicinity, even with its tiny little spacecraft telescope, compared to the gigantic telescopes that we have here on Earth. About 10 times better resolution, but it's still...
It's an 8-inch reflector, similar to like the ones we have out in the yard.
Right. So it's not a big telescope.
Sure, no.
Right. But it is much, 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 much closer.
Yeah.
And so for objects that are close enough to New Horizons, they have better resolution than we get from our ground-based, big ground-based telescopes. And for some of these objects... They still look like just a smudge of light.
Yeah.
Like the pictures just look like a little smudge of light, but the smudge is slightly elongated. And so what they did was they said, okay, let's suppose that the object that produced that smudge is a single blob. And then they model what sort of smudge of light that single blob would produce on their telescope imaging, and they subtract that from the image that they got, and what they found was two leftover blobs of light. So then they said, well, what if it was actually two blobs?
Not one blob.
And they model that, and there's no leftover light. So based on that, they conclude that they have discovered some additional binaries in the Kuiper Belt, which by itself is not revolutionary because we've seen a lot of these objects have moons, but in these cases, they're much, much closer together than what because you can't see things that close together from the Earth.
Yeah.
So
tight binaries.
Yeah, but Arrokoth, you said, is like a, I mean, it kind of looks like a dumbbell thing, right?
Yeah.
Or there's some other objects that are basically like, yeah, these contact binaries where they're.
Right. Yeah.
So did they model that? I mean, what?
So if I had been at the press conference, that's the question I would have asked exactly, which is, okay, did you model a very oblong single object for the light? And these are very knowledgeable scientists.
Sure, yeah.
And so there's a big difference in the light reflecting area of even something like Arrokoth, which has an aspect ratio of like maybe 3 to 1 or something like that. So it's very oblong, but the binaries that they're getting to fit these have an aspect ratio of like 100 to 1
oh.
or something. They're like kilometer sized. Maybe it's not that big.
Not
it's
that
10
big.
To 1, 10 to 1. But the they're separation like, of the things is...
They're like 30 or 50 kilometer wide objects that are like 150 kilometers apart.
Okay.
That's pretty
well,
big.
That's only about a 3 or 4 to 1 aspect ratio. So then the question would be, could it be a big potato-shaped object? I guess what you're saying, Jim, is could it be a big potato-shaped object that's 150 kilometers long, but is not two separate things?
Or even right? just, yes. I mean, a lot of these things have like two lobes and a neck, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So,
that's what I'm saying.
So oblong, but like much skinnier in the center. That's got to look, have a, you know, a light signature that looks very similar to.
Right. So I think the missing piece is, can you actually sustain something that's 150 kilometers across that is sustained by
it's that long?
That's a single physical thing
right.
that's as elongated as you need to make it
right.
Okay. reproduce the light.
Right.
So that's one of the updates
how
from
big
the
was,
DPS.
How long was
Arrokoth?
No. The interplanetary one.
Oumuamua.
Yeah. Was that the one? Was it Oumuamua or Borisov that was like really
or
elongated?
Or Borisov. They were always drawn as these very elongated things.
Oumuamua.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway.
So anyway, that's something that will require seeing the paper in publication to know more details
yes.
about. They're calling them tight twins.
Tight twins.
Tight twins. All right.
Also, whatever.
Nope.
I'm not going to go there.
Nope.
The other news, asteroid
outer
related.
Solar system, yeah. From this press, from a different press conference.
On a different day, yeah.
And back to Lucy, right?
Right, yeah. Also related to binaries.
Yeah, was it they... So we knew there's like 7 total... Originally there were like 6 total objects that they were going to target with Lucy, the Lucy mission. So they're mostly all in one.
All Trojan asteroids.
Yes. Yeah. There's one main belt asteroid they're going to look at on the way out.
Is that the Don
Johnson,
or whatever?
Yeah.
there's an asteroid called Addie Dove and an asteroid called Joshua Cole. There's also one called
like Donald Johnson or something like that.
They're
like
flying
that.
By. Yeah.
And so they originally, I thought it was like 6 objects or something, and most of them are in one lobe. I think there's like 1 or 2
in the
other lobe, and then there's 1 main belt object. But it turns out they're actually going to go to at least like 7 or 8 objects now, because we already knew that one of the Patroclus has a binary companion, and I guess they just discovered that a new Eurybides
right.
has a satellite
called Queta.
Queta. And Eurybides is a big asteroid. It's a pretty big one of the larger of the Trojan asteroids.
Right. The Trojan asteroid's name for
satellite. The Trojan.
There's a bunch. I mean, there's so many that.
I think they're mostly Trojan, like that sort of.
Yeah, the big ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patrocles would be a. Those are both
Polymeli.
Greek.
Polymeli. Yeah. I think they're.
Yeah. In any event, they just recently discovered a new moon of one of the target asteroids. They're not 100% sure that they'll be able to get that they're where its orbit is to know where it will be when the Lucy spacecraft gets there. So they don't yet know for sure whether or not they'll be able to get really good observations of this moon, Queta, which is on a much more distant orbit from that asteroid than these tight KBO tight twin binaries.
I guess
Queta
was discovered by HST images in 2018.
Well, phooey. What was that DPS
I don't know.
Presser about? Because it sure sounded like they were excited to report that.
Maybe they're just excited about it.
Maybe it's the orbit is close enough that they think they'll be able to see it.
Maybe.
All right. Interesting. Okay. Well, let's see what you think about these animal space
animals.
Adventures.
Space animals.
Space.
Our
animals.
First question is, what was the first animal we sent into space? Pretty simple, right?
Give us my choices again.
Your choices are fruit fly.
I thought wasn't even on the list. So
fruit fly, rhesus monkey, mouse, rat, and bullfrog was your choice. Dog.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it wasn't like a sorry.
I thought it was.
Yeah.
I didn't even. I had no idea that they sent all these other wheel.
As I mentioned, this was a suborbital, and it was into. It was to an altitude of 110 kilometers or something like that. So it was above. It's about the same kind of flight that William Shatner is going on, but much more violent. So higher G levels, because the whole flight was like 3.5 minutes instead of 10 minutes. But the animal in question survived the flight.
Okay.
So your choices were fruit fly, rhesus monkey, mouse, rat, bullfrog. What do you say?
Mouse.
I think it's the rhesus monkey.
It is the fruit fly.
Oh.
Fruit fly.
1947.
Fruit fly is an easy one. We do a lot.
It's so
we
tiny.
Do send fruit flies on things a lot.
Yeah. 1947 from White Sands, a V2 rocket.
Because I know we did the Ham and Baker and Sam. Those were all the monkey names.
Yeah. What was the first animal to orbit the moon? A tortoise?
When was the fruit fly?
47.
Okay, because the rhesus monkey was in 1948.
Right.
So that wasn't far off.
Yeah. What was Albert. The first animal to orbit the moon? You can't be Googling this stuff. You're going to find the answer.
I Googled that after.
I know, but you're accidentally going to see.
I'm not going to accidentally
you're
see.
You're accidentally going to see the answer to the next question.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first animal to orbit the moon? Tortoise, human, rhesus monkey, dog, or snail?
I don't know what the Russians did.
I'm going to say human.
I'm also going to say human.
Well, in time, you're quite close because the Apollo 8, right, was the first humans to orbit the moon. And that was in December of 1968.
Yeah.
This flight was actually in September of 1968, and it was a Russian mission.
Yeah. It was a turtle.
It was a turtle.
Yeah.
What?
It was tortoises.
Tortoises are different from turtles.
It was tortoises.
Really?
Yes.
That
a couple of small tortoises.
Why a tortoise?
Why not?
They're just sort of easy to manage somehow. And also, I think that they can survive without
much
sustenance for a long period of time.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
So the Zone
5 mission launched on
September 14th, 1968. First spacecraft to orbit the moon and return safely to the Earth. It was about almost a 7-day mission. Actually splashed down. Did not land in the
And then the turtle was released to the
did
tortoise
the tortoises
was released
survive?
To the ocean.
The tortoises did survive. They even though the splashdown, you know, this was Cold War era, so we don't have a lot of, you know, details, but the entry was maybe not the optimal entry, so they were off in the ocean and therefore steeper and higher G-forces, which some have suggested would not have been survivable by people.
Mm-hmm.
The capsule wasn't even opened until 4 days after splashdown, but the animals were alive.
They were alive?
Yeah.
Are they still alive? Tortoises live for like a very long time.
They are not.
They are not?
No.
Yeah, I was trying to remember, because I knew like we hadn't sent any missions around the moon that had animals on them, so it knew it had to be the Russians.
Yeah, or it could have been, you know, it could have just been us, right?
Yeah, that's why
it could
I said
have been
humans.
The Apollo. I mean, I shouldn't say us. But us
I knew
humans.
If it was the U.S., it was humans. I
right.
couldn't figure out.
Right.
I couldn't remember how soon the Russians did it. Darn it!
Finally,
Russians.
What was the first species to produce young?
Space booty
that were conceived in space. Was it the fruit fly? Humans. Mouse, seahorse, or cockroach?
Fruit fly.
Cockroach.
It is the cockroach.
No.
Oh, yes.
Bonus
Why?
Points. You want to guess when? Ballparkish.
Never. It should never happen.
Never happen. This
is a Tracy Becker
actually
question.
On a mission. It was an ESA Russian mission.
Ew. They actually, can you imagine flying? Okay, if this is a good stumper sometime, what would you rather not fly with? Because if I was put on a mission and they were like, we're going to fly some cockroaches with you, I would be like, no, thank you. I am not going on that mission.
That's bizarre.
I'm not even sure if there were people on this mission.
Oh, good.
I don't think there were. I think it was devoid of human presence. But this one did include the long duration exposure of tardigrades to space.
Oh, so good.
So tardigrades.
10 days. And it included, among many other things, a sealed container with cockroaches.
And I mean, were they intentionally trying to get the cockroaches
as we have previously discussed, people are doing all sorts of strange things, like shooting tardigrades out of a gun, you know,
cockroaches
in a can,
I assume.
And
there's so many of
space,
them.
You know, they put them in a sealed container and they captured video. So there is a sex tape.
There is a sex tape from space.
There is a cockroach sex tape from space. And the cockroach that produced the young... 33 youngsters, Addie.
Oh, yes.
See, this is why they're awful.
33.
33 youngsters.
Nice.
The proud mother is got a name, Nadezhda.
Nadezhda.
So.
I would rather fly with, like, rats, spiders.
Yeah.
Ants. Anything else.
Anything but cockroaches. Yeah. Yeah. That could be nasty, right?
And also,
now
they're
I want
still
to change
there.
What I got you for your baby shower. I want to get it all cockroach themed stuff.
Oh,
cockroach themed
so
onesie.
Mean. So mean.
You're so mean.
You're a little cockroach.
Yeah.
Gross.
Well, it may have felt like counting to one microsecond in attoseconds. It was just another episode of Walk About the Galaxy. Write us a review in the binary language of moisture vaporators. And then tell us what a moisture vaporator is.
Is that the pronunciation?
What do you think it is?
I don't know.
That's what he says, isn't it, in Star Wars?
I don't know.
Episode 4, Uncle Owen.
I guess
says,
so.
What I really need is a droid who can speak the binary language of moisture vaporators.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right? To C-3PO?
It just sounds weird.
It does sound weird. That's why we need to know what it is.
Okay.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram to get all our updates and check out our website at walkaboutthegalaxy.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can see most of our episodes, some of our bloopers, and all of our music videos. Catch up on old episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter.
@walk_that_galaxy.
And ask us questions anywhere using #AskWTG or simply ask us at WTG@UCF.edu. Our theme music was composed by Richard Jurusik. Production assistance provided by Diego Rodriguez. Thanks to our listeners in Illinois and around the world. Stay safe. I'm Josh Caldwell.
I'm Addie Dove.
And I'm Jim Cooney.
We're the Astrocork signing off until the next episode of Walk About the Galaxy.